Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, some hospitals are failing to comply with the state law when it comes to treating sexual assault survivors. We'll learn what an investigation uncovered. Also, Illinois taxpayers could be on the hook for hundreds of millions of dollars under a plan to help state employees lose weight. A one-time anti-vaxxer is now a vaccine advocate. What led to the change, and what advice does she have for the public health community? We'll visit a woman's kitchen, which has become a gathering place for local teenagers. And we'll also attend a wedding for more than a dozen couples who also happen to be asylum seekers. Those stories and more are on the way on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Some Illinois lawmakers are upset after learning that the governor's office quietly expanded coverage of the cost of injectable medicines to help state workers lose weight. It could cost the state hundreds of millions of dollars, but the governor's office says it's about equity, ensuring all state workers get access to drugs they hope drive healthcare costs down. Dave McKinney reports.
Drugs like Ozempic or Wegovy have been called miracle drugs, talked up by the likes of Oprah Winfrey and former NBA star Charles Barkley for how they dramatically help people shed weight.
You know, man, I started this drug called Mounjaro about 6 months ago, and I'm down 57 pounds. It's been amazing.
That's Barkley last year on ESPN's Pat McAfee show.
I have zero idea what it does. I know it's working, though.
These injectable weight loss drugs can cost as much as $16,000 a year, and it's a struggle to get health insurance to cover it, except for a fortunate few in Illinois. State workers get the drugs insured for their obesity beginning July 1st in a move that could be a slam dunk on Illinois taxpayers. Pritzker's office defends its under-the-radar push to cover the drugs for obese government employees, saying it'll lead to a healthier workforce and eventually lower health care costs. But the four-sentence add-on to the 899-page budget bill comes as news 11 months later to some lawmakers steeped in knowing the state budget. I asked Republican State Senator Chapin Rose when he found out about it.
When you called me.
It's even bigger news to Rose that the Pritzker administration expects the cost to be $210 million for 1 year.
Dropping a bill out of the air on the last day of session with something in it that nobody knows about and then blowing the doors off the budget, that is insanity.
Emails WBEZ obtained show the initiative was first proposed by Pritzker's chief of staff and that it proceeded despite warnings about the cost from the governor's own budget director and the head of the agency overseeing the state insurance program. And at least one expert thinks the cost could be higher than $210 million. Ryan Cummings is a former White House economist under Democratic President Joe Biden and has studied how these costly drugs can be government budget busters. In one scenario, Cummings estimates the new coverage mandate in Illinois could cost three times the state's estimate, depending on the number of people who access the program. If that happens, Cummings warns hard budget choices await the state if it can't win cheaper prices for the drugs from pharmaceutical companies, which can't seem to produce them quickly enough.
Do you force people to pay more in their premiums? Do you issue new bonds to finance this? Do you have to raise taxes? Or do you tell people who are on it, sorry, you got to get off of it now, and now you're going to gain your weight back? So again, there's a lot of invidious choices if we can't figure out collectively as a government and as, you know, policymakers, a way to get the cost of this drug down.
Pritzker's office dismissed Cummings' calculations, calling them, quote, a back-of-the-napkin cost analysis. Even if the Pritzker administration's own estimate proves true, an unexpected $210 million bill coming due is something Democratic State Representative Fred Crespo wishes he'd have known last year instead of learning it from WBEZ. The veteran lawmaker chairs one of five budget writing committees in the House and, like others, didn't spot the weight loss drug component in last year's budget implementation legislation, known in Springfield as the BIMP bill. No one mentioned it.
This initiative for obesity was put in the BIMP bill, and to my knowledge, it was never vetted. It was never discussed. That's a dangerous game.
As loudly as backers like Charles Barkley trumpet the impact of injectable weight loss drugs, their supporters in Springfield have mostly stayed quiet. Now, the cost of that silence is coming due. This is Dave McKinney.
Just a few years ago, Heather Simpson refused to get any vaccines for her child. Now she's a pro-vaccine advocate. She tours the country to explain her transformation and how she talks to others about the vaccine hesitancy and fears she once had. Simpson, a single mom from Western Texas, was the keynote speaker at the Illinois Department of Public Health's Infectious Disease Conference. Simpson told reporter Eric Dito she changed her mind about vaccines during a time when health misinformation was running rampant in the early stages of the COVID pandemic.
You know, I really did think that vaccines were the enemy, that they would cause autism, allergies, cancer, everything bad ever. And then COVID hit. You know, I had all these followers, all these anti-vax followers that supported my thoughts on vaccines, and I really thought I was in the right. Like, I would post all my anti-vax thoughts thinking if I could save one child from getting vaccinated, I would save a life, and that would be all worth it. But when COVID hit and my anti-vax followers just waged a war on masks, I started thinking, like, that's kind of weird that you're acting like martyrs. You could just wear a mask and save a whole life. It kind of gave me this weird feeling of entitlement. I kind of got the ick from the whole thing. And I kind of pushed away from them. And I started reading science and listening to doctors and talking to them about my questions about polysorbate 80 and aluminum. And they broke them down into piece by piece arguments that completely shattered my anti-vax beliefs, and I had no leg to stand on anymore after that.
Can you kind of run through your early conversations with medical professionals when you first brought up your fears and anxieties? How did they address that?
I had watched a 9-hour docuseries that promised to be, you know, middle ground, and it was anything but, and that's kind of how I became an anti-vaxxer. You know, it said if you want to vaccinate your kid and be a monster and let them die, then do that. But if you love your child and you want to keep them away from all harm forever, then don't vaccinate your kid. That's kind of how I became an anti-vaxxer after watching those 9 hours. But I would go to like my OBGYN and tell him what I saw in the docuseries, and he would just shut it down immediately and say, you're not one of those crazy anti-vaxxers, are you? And I would just turn beet red and cry in my car. I went to my pediatrician when my daughter was born, and I tried to talk about the docuseries, what I learned in it, and I wanted her to convince me otherwise, but she just crossed her arms. I literally remember her crossing her arms and saying, I won't talk about that. They just didn't want to talk about it. And I could have been convinced earlier on. This didn't have to happen.
So what would your advice be for those medical professionals? How should they approach somebody who comes to them with anxieties or fears similar to the ones that you had?
My advice would be just realize that they want to keep their kid alive and they are really scared. Or if they're not a parent and they're just concerned about vaccines for themselves, they don't want to die either. And this really usually has a lot to do with anxiety, and they want you to convince them otherwise. They want to trust you. Get ahead of it. Learn what they're going to ask and know how to break down that science. Don't shut them down. Don't say they're crazy. If you don't know the answer, say, that's a really good question. I can see why that would be concerning. Let me find out and I'll get back to you.
What kind of specific language and tactics do communities like an anti-vaccine use to get people to buy in and stay a part of that community?
We believe you. We won't gaslight you. We know that what happened to your kid is true. What you believe happened to your kid is the truth. We believe that vaccines caused this. We stand behind you. Basically, we're here for you. The doctors are the enemy. We'll support you in this. They use all the right words that I wish the medical community would use more of.
So what led you to originally post your thoughts on Facebook for the first time?
I had been watching these mostly women talk about their anti-vax beliefs on Facebook and just thinking, that's so bold and brave, and I really wish I could do that. And I was so lonely out in West Texas as a mom of a very young child whose husband worked all the time, didn't have close friends or family, and I needed a community. And I wanted a community, and I thought, you know, this is so embarrassing. I don't really want people to know I'm an anti-vaxxer, but what if I just tried and I was welcome into that community? And I certainly was, and it blew up bigger than I ever really dreamed. But I did get the community that I wanted from that post.
I really liked one of your quotes from your presentation. You said, people are not monsters. People are just people. Can you kind of go a little deeper into that?
We like to look at the issue as the person themselves, that we're fighting the people. We're fighting an anti-vaxxer, like, as a whole person, like they are the bad guy, when really it's anxiety we're fighting, it's misinformation we're fighting, it's people with money that run ads that we're fighting. We're not fighting the freaked out mom, you know? Our fight isn't against people, it's against ideas and bigger things outside of that. So we're fighting the lies and the misinformation and the people with the money, and not just the people that want to keep their kids safe.
You mentioned, when we were talking about the language used by anti-vax people, such as those people with money playing these ads, and you said it would be better if the medical professionals and pro-vax community could use the same kind of language. What can you do about that to kind of spread the correct information and make sure that people are getting all of the facts, even though it's not necessarily coming from a doctor, it's just someone that they could see on the internet?
Yeah, I think the pro-vaccine medical science world, they're very nice online. And a lot of times it's because they have to be because of their jobs and things like that. But I think we don't have to be mean, but we can be bold. You know that 9-hour docuseries the anti-vaxxers did? Having a 9-hour docuseries about the terrifying truth of polio and measles and things like that, like fighting fire with fire doesn't have to be mean. It can just be like, hey, this is actually really terrifying and you need to sit down. Like that, like this is the facts. And I just see so many like pretty pictures that are like, do it for the community. And that's not effective for the younger generation. They don't care. They want to be kept alive. They want their kids to be kept alive. And we got to fight fire with fire. And that doesn't make you mean. That just makes you strong.
How would you approach a conversation now with somebody who is an anti-vaxxer? What would you say to them to kind of begin to change their minds and have them start to see things the way that you did?
I think I would initially ask them what their biggest fear is. Like, what is the worst case scenario in your mind if you vaccinate your child? What, like, literally the worst case? They're probably going to say death. Why do you think that? Well, because I heard this story. What I like to tell people is, I was supposed to get my flu shot one day, but I had a reaction to an antibiotic that morning and started throwing up blood. So I had to cancel my flu shot. Had I gotten my flu shot that morning, I would have attributed the throwing up blood to the flu shot and posted it online. Probably a few hundred or a few thousand people would now think the flu shot causes throwing up blood. So really breaking it down to, like, what story did you read that made you think that? Let's walk backwards from your biggest fear and how unlikely that is. You know what I mean? But meet them where they're at. Be like, that's scary. Like, that would be scary to think that your child could die. That's a legitimate fear, and that must be really scary to live like that. And I'm so sorry that you have that fear. That sucks. I'm so sorry. Yeah, you're not a monster. I see that you love your kid.
Absolutely. Can you kind of walk through the idea of taking it slowly? Singular vaccines over the combination vaccine. Just being able to take it slowly, step by step. What are kind of the benefits that you see in that?
I know that there is a CDC schedule. I think the push to make parents stick to that schedule, anxious parents, is doing more harm than good. And having a fully vaccinated 5-year-old, even if they did it one at a time, once a month, versus a fully unvaccinated 5-year-old because you kicked them out of your clinic because they didn't stick to the fast schedule, is really unfortunate. You know, I think it's worth it to have the slowly vaccinated child. I don't know the logistics of what that would look like, having the not fully vaccinated kids sitting in one part of the waiting room versus newborn. I don't know the logistics. I just know that I'd rather have a fully vaccinated, yet slowly vaccinated 5-year-old than not at all.
So what inspires you to share your story? What brings you to stand up on a stage and in a room full of infectious disease specialists and talk to them about this?
My daughter wouldn't be here right now if I hadn't fought for her. And with the doctors that gaslit me and just completely blew me off, she wouldn't be here, you know? And so I am so passionate about patient-doctor communication and doctors and nurses and people seeing parents as human beings that want to keep their kids alive and a path forward, you know, whether that's singular vaccines or slower schedules or anything. Like, there's going to have to be compromise. Like, we can argue all day long on Facebook and Twitter, and that's fun and all, but at some point, if we want to get the rates up, there's got to be a way forward. And not everybody's going to be happy, but there's going to be compromise, and there are ways to do it. And I'm prepared to not be the popular person in that. But I really think that there's a way forward that makes a lot of people happy and gets the vaccine rates up. And I really want to see that happen.
Vaccine advocate Heather Simpson, she spoke with reporter Eric Dito. Simpson was the keynote speaker at the Illinois Department of Public Health's Infectious Disease Conference. There is an effort underway in Illinois to decriminalize paid consensual sex work between adults. Alex Degman reports.
For Raina Ortiz, it's a matter of safety. She was a sex worker for 20 years. She told a City Club of Chicago luncheon that workers often don't seek help, even if they need it.
When sex workers face assault or see someone being assaulted or even see someone that they think is facing the violence of trafficking, they are unlikely to go to police for fear of being arrested ourselves.
Ortiz says a decriminalized industry would reserve more police resources to go after human traffickers. Equality Illinois is also pushing for decriminalization, but not necessarily legalization, which they say could open the door to burdensome regulations. I'm Alex Degman.
Still on the way on Statewide, we'll take you to Grandma Peggy's Breakfast Club and learn more about the bond she has with local teenagers. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Every Wednesday morning, an intimate yet sometimes large gathering takes place at a home in South St. Louis, where 35 people convene for breakfast. Emily Woodbury introduces us to Grandma Peggy's Breakfast Club.
We have to fry some eggs because not everybody likes scramble.
Peggy Winkowski wakes up at 4:30 a.m. to start cooking in the home she's lived in for 47 years.
I said if you get an eggshell into your egg, you scoop it out with the eggshell. It's like a magnet. Don't use your finger because it just floats around.
She's getting ready to host students for breakfast before they head to Bishop DeBerg High School. Wednesdays are late arrival days for the students, but these teens forego sleeping in to come here. Peggy tries to have a new menu each week, and it's quite the spread today.
We have probably 12 pounds of bacon. I have 10 pounds of chicken, fried chicken that I've already fried. I'm just going to heat up in the oven with biscuits. And we have a cinnamon roll casserole. We have another casserole in here. I make it all with love.
It all started on a Wednesday in October 2021 with Peggy's grandsons and seven of their friends.
Yeah, that we had juniors and seniors and sophomores that all came. Freshmen, sophomores, and juniors that came for Breakfast Club. And there was the original nine. And then after they left the first day, they're all like, Grandma Peggy, what's next week? And we had it every Wednesday.
The casual breakfast turned into a regular gathering, and it became particularly special after the loss of Peggy's grandson, Sam Crow, who was killed in a vehicle crash in 2022 at age 15.
I lost Sam, but I got all these extra kids that love me. They'll call me Grandma Peggy. Yeah, so on the day that they all made their soccer division, they all won their soccer division team. And I'm like, we're sitting in the stand, I'm their biggest fan. And I said, well, one of their biggest fans, everybody is the fan at DeBerg. I'm telling you what, they went from winning no games to being into second place of state. But when they were all running off the field, I'm like, oh, they're going to go get their pictures taken. They ran to the stands to sing happy birthday to Grandma Peggy. It was priceless. I said, I don't know. It's just, that they want to come every day to come and eat breakfast when they could sleep in, I will feed them until the day they don't want to come anymore. Yeah, you know, there's no promises, but I'll probably still be kicking when I'm 90 making breakfast. Because like, it's my job. It's my fun job.
Peggy was close with her grandson, Sam. They shared a history of eating breakfast together over the years.
His dad would work at 4:30 in the morning, and then he would drop my Sam off here, and then he would get ready, I'd feed him breakfast, he'd get his school stuff, and then he would go to school with his cousins two doors down, and then his dad could go to work, and his mom could go to work, and nobody had to worry about him. And that was fine. It was wonderful. But then I'm like, do you have to bring him at 4:30 in the morning? Can he... You keep him all night until it's time for him to go to bed and then bring him here and then I'll just get him up at 7? So then Sam started to spend the night here and it's just got to be like, I'm going to get so used to him being here. Can you run my trash out in the morning before I take you to school? And worked out well for everybody. It was a win-win. But I think I miss that so much.
There are remembrances of Sam throughout the house, a memorial garden on the front lawn, photos of him on the walls, and in the kitchen, an apron that reads Grandma Peggy's Breakfast Club in memory of Sam.
My cousin bought me this for my Christmas present, and she put Sam on there. And my boy, 15 and a legacy, he's got a basketball tournament named after him at St. Stephen's Grade School. It used to be called the Hoops for Christmas, and they would practice, the eighth graders, all the eighth grade teams around the city would play basketball tournaments. Well, now they named it Sam Crow's Basketball Tournament. I'm like, and then they retired his number 6 jersey, and now we have a scholarship at Bishop DeBerg for Sam, $1,000 for one girl and $1,000 for one boy, which doesn't seem like a lot of money, but it's a month rent free. You know, it's a 1 month free of tuition, so it's a start. But you know what, I'm going to get him to have an endowment. That's my next journey.
Around 7 a.m., students begin to filter in.
I'm like, come on, boys, good morning. How are you? Welcome to our breakfast club.
Jeremy Rader is a junior at DeBerg High School. He was one of Sam's friends.
Grandma, she's basically just our built-in grandma, so.
When you say built-in grandma, what do you mean by that?
She just cares for us like she is our real grandma, and so that's what we all call her. We call her our grandma, uh-huh. So I mean, simple
and
as that.
Do you have grandmas?
I have two grandmas, so and they're both in my life. It's not like they're not, but she's the third grandma, and I see her with my friends all the time, so she's like all of our grandmas together. That's what brings us, you know, as a family.
Maya Dozier was friends with Sam since their freshman year. She started coming to Peggy's house after Sam passed. She doesn't get to see her own grandma often, so she cherishes the Wednesday breakfasts at Peggy's house.
And it's a sense of community, especially if you don't feel like you belong anywhere. Like, you belong here no matter what. Random people come sometimes. And it's just, like, a great sense of community. We all care for each other and all went through a rough patch together. So, essentially, it's just, like, kind of a support group for each other. And it just kind of keeps Sam's memory alive.
Sam's friend Corey Mackey was one of the original Breakfast Club members.
I mean, I think friendship helps, like, being able to move on or whatever you have to do to get your sorrow. I can't think of the word right now. But I think the kids that did know him and the people that did know him, it's something to relate to each other, and it's something that we can always, like, if you need someone, you know that you've went through something, and that builds stronger connections, and it's something you can't really experience unless you experience it, you know?
Peggy and the students have a text group where they stay in touch throughout the week and plan dishes for their next get-together.
Well, what we really need to get is a text screen to say who's coming, because sometimes I never know if there's 11 or if there's 30. I never want to run out of food, and we never would. I mean, I'd sit here and make some more pancakes, or I'd sit here and make some more French toast. I would just keep cooking until they were done. Nobody's going to leave here hungry, and everybody's going to leave here happy, hopefully.
Set up an open table.
It is an open table. It's an open table, and then when they all leave, because, you know, we like real plates. We don't use paper plates here. So when they get done, this whole counter will full of dishes, and we have one dishwasher. And Grandma, they're like, Grandma, you want us to help you? I'm like, No, of course not. I want you to visit. I want you to talk. There's plenty of time for dishes. They will wait. They'll wait. I said, the most important is to have fun with them and to listen to what they say and how they talk. And, you know, and they're just like, you know, they can always come here. It will be a safe house. I mean, if they ever needed to get somebody and they want to, they're maybe don't want to talk to their mom or their dad, but they can call me. Don't get me wrong. I will call their mom and dad and tell them, hey, he's here. He's safe. I'm not stepping on anybody's toes. I just want them to know if they're busy and they need somebody, I will take care of it. You know, that's what grandmas do.
Peggy takes care of much more than the dishes. After she says goodbye to the students and gets done cleaning up from breakfast, she starts caretaking for her husband, who lives with Alzheimer's, dementia, and Parkinson's.
You know, by the time you get him into the shower, get him his breakfast, get him his dress, and then sometimes you have to get him dressed again. You know, and then it's like, ooh, it's a lot. I mean, hopefully he can continue to take care of him for a long time. And I think that when he can't start getting out of bed anymore, then I might have to go to plan B, but I don't know. Just one day at a time. I can't be worried about that. I got to worry about today because we know tomorrow doesn't come sometimes. You know what? Every day when I think that I'm feeling sad, I get a sign. I believe in the signs and I believe that, but like these kids, they would do anything for me and the world. I mean, they're like, Grandma, can we come clean your house? You know, I mean, what can we do for you? I mean, these kids are like no other. They have so much love and so much respect, and they're all so polite and so kind, and this is the future we want. You know, we want these kids to be our future, and I want more kids to be like them, but they can't if they don't have a Grandma Peggy. Our good parents are good schooling. You know, some people just, you know, push them through, and they don't get what they get here and what they give me. I mean, it goes both ways. You give love, you get love. You know, but people are taught to hate. Everybody's born with love, but you have to continue that. You know, I mean, I think that they know that I love them here.
As we talk, several of the teens begin slow dancing to Lovey and Rose in Peggy's living room.
They're the best kids ever. I mean, they are old souls. Do you know? They're just, look at their dancing. Peggy can teach you all how to dance. I'm quite the dancer, you know. That's a little swing dance. Now over your arms. There you go.
Peggy hopes the story of their Wednesday Breakfast Club inspires others to do something similar.
You know, and I think there should be a movement, you know, maybe an international, national movement of let's have breakfast on Wednesdays to get over the hump. I don't care if it's just a cup of coffee with your friend, but let's talk about what you did last week and let's talk about some good things coming up. Let's don't talk about what's going on in the world today because this has been going on in our world forever. We just didn't know about it so much, you know. I mean, I don't really know, but I think that this was a terrible story that we tried to turn happy, you know, and it is happy. We have tears of joy and tears of sadness, and I will get up at 4:30 in the morning as long as they will come and eat.
With Sam's friends heading into their senior year in the fall, and with Peggy's granddaughter attending high school in a few years, Peggy may very well have many more early mornings to come.
Emily Woodbury with that report on Peggy Winkowski of St. Louis. She's better known as Grandma Peggy. You can read more about the relationship she has with local teenagers. There's a link at our show page. The Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum in Springfield is now home to a document that historians say helped start the Civil War. The letter from Lincoln asked the Secretary of State to officially enact the 1861 Anaconda Plan. It formed a blockade on southern states following the Confederate attack on Fort Sumter. The blockade crippled Confederate cotton and tobacco exports and kept weapons and supplies from getting in. Library and Museum Director Christina Schutt says it was Lincoln's turning point in the war.
Now the president must decide whether to act boldly to win a war the Confederacy has started or dither and hope that somehow the crisis fades.
Governor J.B. Pritzker and First Lady M.K. Pritzker bought the document at auction and donated it to the Springfield Museum. It will be on display there until February. One of Chicago's Park Community Churches in what's known as the Uptown neighborhood has been a lifeline for migrants and asylum seekers. As families seek to live a normal life, couples want to get married. But getting married in Venezuela is expensive and cumbersome with paperwork. So the church held a wedding for 15 couples. Adriana Cardona-McGeegan attended, and she has this audio postcard.
In a church classroom, anxious brides put on wedding dresses. They do each other's makeup and fix their veils and tiaras. Yamilet Parra is staying at a migrant shelter on the north side with her partner Herbert Guillen and their two kids. They've been together for 15 years. Parra is excited about the wedding. She loves her dress.
Bueno, el vestido pues no los consiguieron. Un vestido prestado, pero un vestido bonito, justo al cuerpo.
She says, although the dress was borrowed, I found the right one. It's tight to the body, the sleeves fall on both sides, it accentuates the waist, and it has a mermaid style. It's beautiful, she says, with spangles.
De lentejuelas.
Parra quickly turns around to help another bride zip up her dress. The women getting ready to say their vows are mostly from Venezuela. Many have children who run around in excitement. They travel through several countries and dangerous places, including the Darien jungle, a journey they'll never forget. Cruzelis Rodriguez says one of the scariest times was jumping off a cargo train as her family tried to reach the U.S.-Mexico border. They took the wrong train, and her kids had to jump before her. She almost lost them. Her partner Luis Rodriguez says he felt like giving up during their journey.
Hubieron momentos en los que empecé a tirar la toalla. De verdad, sí, sentí mucha frustración.
They slept on the streets of Guatemala, Costa Rica, and Mexico.
Guatemala. Costa Rica.
Getting married has legal, health, and immigration benefits. But marriage also solidifies their relationship in the church, something the couple has long wanted to do for their family.
Estoy super agradecido, tanto con Chicago como
Luis Rodriguez tears up as he thanks God and also people in Chicago for all the help and for the family that he now has.
Por esta familia que me regaló.
With the help of the church, the couples planned this wedding with a budget of about $2,500. Couples chipped in about $150 each. An asylum seeker catered the food, chicken with rice, pasta, and salad. The table centerpieces were recycled from other events. The cakes came from the grocery store but were redecorated with roses. The theme colors are gold, white, and black. Each bride carried a bouquet. The dresses, suits, and other accessories for the women, men, and the kids are mostly donated. The big moment eventually arrives in the main worship auditorium. 15 grooms stand in the front. Each bride is called one by one. They walk toward the front with their children. More than 150 people are there to witness this moment. Pastor Ed Kral guides each couple through their wedding vows. The couples then light a candle that symbolizes their union. Pastor Kral asks the couples to look each other in the eyes.
Por favor, ve uno al otro.
And then
tengo el gozo.
Pronounces the 15 couples.
Y el privilegio de declararles maridos y mujeres.
Husband and wife.
Que se besen.
And they kiss. Adriana Cardona Magigad, WBEC News.
There is more to come on Statewide. Stay right here. You're tuned in to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Still to come, we'll tell you about an investigation that found some Illinois hospitals failing to provide rape kits to sexual assault survivors. But first, according to the Illinois Department of Natural Resources, the state had 22 million acres of prairie land in 1820. By 1978, less than 2,300 acres of quality prairie remained. There are efforts to protect what's left and, in some cases, restore prairie. Colin Shope has more.
Sarah Livesey is the executive director of the Grand Prairie Friends Land Trust, the conservation organization formed in 1984.
Started purchasing and protecting and then restoring some of those original tallgrass prairie remnants. We stretch 130 miles north to south, so Watseka, Illinois, up to the north, all the way down through Charleston, Illinois, down to Neoga, Illinois.
That adds up to about 1,200 acres. Livesey says there are around 60 land trusts owning prairie land in Illinois, but most of Illinois' remaining prairie isn't owned by conservation groups or even the government.
The interesting thing in Illinois is that more than 90% of the land is in private landholder ownership. So the private individual owns most of the land.
For conservation groups like Grand Prairie Friends, that means an important part of the job is reaching out to private owners and teaching them about restoration.
For example, we just had a national chainsaw trainer come in and talk, and we opened it to the community so they could come and learn the effective ways of using a chainsaw so we can do timber stand improvement and all of those kind of things and remove invasive plants. So yes, we have an obligation, I would say.
Some other measures also help with invasive species. For example, the prescribed burns, like the ones taking place out at Wilmington's Midowin Tallgrass Prairie this spring. Livesey says these practices are important to keep out invasive species like garlic mustard, which chokes out native wildflowers.
Luckily, here in Illinois, being on the tallgrass prairie, most of our native plants and some trees have that immunity to fire. Many of them are adapted to open their seed pods with fire, or the prairies regenerate after fire, and that rich amount of burnt material then goes back into the soil.
Conservation-minded groups also have to practice preservation to raise the numbers of certain species in Illinois prairies. One of the largest landowners in Illinois, the State Department of Transportation, is one of these groups. With 429,000 acres of right-of-way across the state, the entity owns a significant amount of prairie and is restoring more in those right-of-way areas.
We started this in 2015-16. We've always, you know, tried to, because don't fight Mother Nature, right? If you plant what's supposed to live there, if it's in a forest, plant trees, if it's in a prairie, plant prairie. It just exists better, better groundwater absorption and everything else.
That's Stephanie Dobbs, a retired IDOT roadside maintenance manager in charge of vegetation. She's back with IDOT, working on contract in her highly specialized field.
We are proactively working to maintain and establish habitat on right-of-way. We partner with many other agencies and private entities, even landowners. We can't spend money on private property, but we can work with them on our side of the fence.
One of the largest projects at IDOT is protecting an endangered species that thrives in Illinois prairies, the monarch butterfly. Dobbs says IDOT contributes by planting and maintaining milkweed, one of the butterfly's main foods. This also means maintaining a seasonal mowing schedule.
I use the salad bar. You know, would you rather eat old salad or would you have brand new fresh salad if you're going to have a salad? So the monarch will go to that fresh milkweed. Also, that reduced pest, that reduced disease that may have been tracked there on that old milkweed.
It's just one more piece of the mission to restore and protect Illinois' prairies from an unexpected steward.
Colin Shope with that report. Advocates for preserving prairies say anyone can get involved by reaching out to their nearest. Decades after the banning of DDT, the American bald eagle faces a new and growing threat, lead poisoning. Tim Shelley tells us more.
Nearly half the eagles tested for a 2022 study showed symptoms of chronic lead poisoning due to repeated lead exposures. and a third displayed signs of acute poisoning caused by high lead levels. Tamara Yarger is founder of Hog Capital Wildlife Rescue and Rehab in Kewaunee. She treats injured animals found throughout a wide swath of central and western Illinois. That includes lead-poisoned eagles. She says it's heartbreaking to treat them.
Their function shut down, their digestive system. It can affect their retinas. It can do neurological damage. I mean, there's so much that we have to fight.
Yarger says the number one source of lead poisoning is ammunition. Eagles are opportunistic eaters, and they often contract lead poisoning by feeding from deer gut piles. No amount of lead in the bloodstream is considered safe for humans or animals. The American Eagle Foundation calls lead poisoning a silent killer and says it's tangibly impacting bald eagle populations. Yarger encourages hunters to use non-lead ammunition.
Just be mindful of what you're putting into nature, because it may seem okay, but it may not be.
More than 3,000 eagles winter in Illinois each year. That's second only to Alaska in the U.S. I'm Tim Shelley.
Reporter Kate Martin with American Public Media recently wrote an investigative piece showing how some Illinois hospitals have been ignoring a state law requiring them to provide a rape kit to sexual assault survivors and notify advocates of the attack. Hospitals in Jacksonville and Anna are among those not complying. Martin recently talked about her story with our Maureen McKinney.
How did you happen to uncover the story about how Illinois sexual assault law has had a lot of hospitals opting out?
Well, it was a little bit of luck and a little bit of curiosity, I suppose. Back in 2018, when I was working for a North Carolina nonprofit news outlet, I noticed Illinois, the legislature had just passed an update to the Sexual Assault Survivors Emergency Treatment Act back in 2018. At the time, I was working on a story that eventually revealed that fewer than one in four people in North Carolina charged with sexual assault are eventually convicted. And so I thought that was really interesting what Illinois was doing and kind of mentally put a pin in it. And I decided with this investigation to sort of see how that 2018 update was going. And it turns out that the story was a lot bigger than just the update in 2018. It had to do with hospitals that are just not following the law. And, you know, talking to dozens and dozens of people, including rape crisis counselors and sexual assault nurse examiners, they gave me really good ideas of where to look. One of the survivors is a girl who is now 7 years old. But at the time she went to the hospital in Jacksonville, she was only four. And her babysitter had caught her touching another child inappropriately and called her mother, and eventually through some sleuthing figured out, you know, the girl told her that her daddy touches her. The grandmother of the girl just insisted on going to the hospital, and they did. But when they got there, even though the hospital at the time, Jacksonville Memorial, was a treatment hospital, which is obligated to treat a sexual assault survivor, the doctor did not offer an exam. They did not call a rape crisis counselor. There's a number of things that the hospital did not do or that the doctor did not do that they were obligated to under Illinois law. The woman, Cheryl Thompson, we actually had a photographer photographing the girl. You know, the photographer had heard from a colleague of hers about Cheryl, and it was this exact issue with, you know, Cheryl went to the hospital in Anna, Illinois, and the doctor there was really dismissive of her, according to her statements to me and her statements in a complaint about the doctor's behavior, and told her that the only way that she could get a rape kit done is if she were to be transferred to a hospital that was almost 80 minutes away. But what he didn't tell her is that a hospital in Carbondale, which is just up the road from Anna, offers rape kits. And by the time she figured that out, it had been more than a week, which to her, she felt like the person who did this to her is going to get away with the crime.
I'd imagine it was very hard for her to relive this. How did you go about easing her mind?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the first thing I tell any sexual assault survivor is that the thing that happened to them was not their choice, and I want them to have power in the interview. I want them to feel like they can say, no, I don't want to answer that question, or no, I don't want to do this interview, and completely respect it. Like most reporters, I think, want to get answers, but when you're talking to somebody who's been so traumatized, you really need to let them lead and just shut up and let them talk, because they have a lot to say if you give them a chance. And, you know, asking them how they felt and just throughout the interview telling them you're allowed to take your time, you know, clear your schedule and make sure that you have that time to give to them, and just let them know how appreciated they are, because the stories that they're telling are really important.
What do the hospitals say about this?
Some of the hospitals were a little contrite. Some of them, they made mistakes. For instance, Advocate South Suburban, they essentially threw away a rape kit for a woman who had been assaulted, even though she wanted to prosecute her rapist. In the wake of that investigation that the state did, and due to my questions, they also said, well, we beefed up our cadre of sexual assault nurse examiners. We've done more training. Instead of turning away from treating sexual assault survivors like the Jacksonville Hospital did, the Jacksonville Hospital stopped treating survivors about a month after, or they told the state a month after that incident that they would no longer treat sexual assault survivors.
Can a hospital do that? Actually say we're not going to help sexual assault survivors?
Under Illinois law, there are two designations for hospitals. One of them is to treat a patient. Some of them are allowed to transfer children to other places because the people who treat children are more specialized and there's fewer of them. The other designation is to transfer patients. So a transfer hospital can, if a sexual assault survivor shows up, they can just tell them, we don't treat a sexual assault survivor, you're going to have to go to this other hospital. That is legal.
Lawmakers who thought they had done a good thing, how have they reacted?
They are really disappointed. State Representative Jihan Gordon Booth, she's a Democrat from Peoria, she said that all of these failures by hospitals, that she was revolted by this. The people who have been victimized, often by trusted people in their lives, are re-victimized again by these hospitals, and she said it was unconscionable.
What do you hope will come out of your reporting?
Currently, this law isn't really being enforced, right? I mean, mm-hmm. The law says if a hospital breaks the law, then they should be charged, they shall be guilty of a petty offense for each violation, and they have to pay a fine that goes into the general fund of whatever municipality they're located in. But as far as I could tell, in the entire 48 years of this law's existence, nobody has ever fined a hospital. No hospital has ever paid any fine ever. And so, I mean, at a bare minimum, the state should figure out how to actually enforce this law to make it better for sexual assault victims.
What number of hospital, or what percentage of hospitals did you determine weren't following the law?
I did a records request with the State Department of Public Health asking for all, essentially all documents related to investigations of the sexual assault survivor law since 2018. And from those, I found that 23 hospitals weren't following the law, and the state has a little less than 200 hospitals. But those are just the ones that we know about. The state only investigates these hospitals once every 3 years or in response to a serious complaint. And from what I understand, they don't actually have a whole lot of people investigating, and they only have one person whose job it is to sort of shepherd those investigators, is my understanding. They also do investigations for 16 other types of medical facilities, so the CICIDA law is not the only thing they're looking into.
What branch of the state government is in charge with holding up the law?
There's two that we know of. So one is the State Department of Public Health. The State Department of Public Health goes out and investigates all of these hospitals once every 3 years. They write their findings in a report, and then they ask the hospitals to respond to those findings by writing what's called a plan of correction. And, you know, the hospitals also have to write a plan for how they are either going to treat sexual assault survivors or what their transfer plan is. That's the Department of Public Health. Then there's the State Attorney General's office, which is supposed to police hospitals that are billing patients or sending sexual assault survivors to collections. And it's not just hospitals doing this, right? Like, you could imagine like physician groups or like testing labs and things like that. They do send patients to collections, or they do bill patients, which is against state law. There's sort of a third category, though, where I haven't been able to figure out, and nobody I've talked to has a definitive answer on. It's the one where the hospitals violating the law shall be guilty of a petty offense, and they have to pay a fine to the municipality where they're located. That third category is sort of a mystery, and I think that lawmakers ought to try to clear that up to see who's supposed to actually enforce that.
That's Kate Martin, a reporter with American Public Media. She talked with Maureen McKinney about an investigation into some Illinois hospitals and their failure to provide rape kits to sexual assault survivors. Read the full story at our show page. That's all the time we have for this episode of Statewide. Thanks for being along with us. Don't forget to join us next time. We'll be back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Find us where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.